From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. On today's show, we're talking with two legendary Southwest Florida journalists upon their return from the Bahamas, where they spent several days learning how some of the hardest hit islands and towns are doing 1 month after Hurricane Dorian parked on top of them for several devastating days. Dorian was the most intense storm on record to hit the Bahamas and is considered to be the worst natural disaster in the country's history. Amy Bennett Williams is a senior writer and storyteller for the News Press. Amy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for – I'm still reeling from being called legendary. Andrew, yes. It's nice to be here.
No, it's
here,
no
Julie.
Question. I'm a huge fan
Thank
of both
you.
Of you guys. So.
So glad to be here.
Well, we're also talking with Andrew West. He's a photographer and visual storyteller for the News Press. Andrew, thanks for being here too.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's great to get you out from behind the camera and talking.
Not much of a talker, but yeah.
I know. But I'll try to pull it out of you. Our conversation is pre-taped, so if you would like to engage with us and our listeners, you can do so via social media. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, okay, how was the decision made to send you guys to the Bahamas? How did this come up?
There was a USA Today reporter, actually a team. They were there on the ground as this was happening. But because the hurricane was so unprecedentedly devastating and the initial phase was such a shock to this very small island nation, we decided to sort of see how things were sorting out a month afterwards. And we would go, we certainly had to talk about what had happened, but we also really wanted to be there with an eye toward progress and rebuilding and what the recovery phase is going to look like now that the crisis has passed.
Well, yeah, it seems like the crisis is continuing, though. But you, from your reporting, it seems like going from the very – at the very first moment, okay, everything's hectic and chaotic. So going a month later, did it seem any less chaotic or was it about how you expected?
I had no expectations. I had never been to the Bahamas before, which I'm now really regretting because it's an amazing place. It was less chaotic and more ghostly. There, mm-hmm. there were the hardest hit places. Most of the population is gone. Most of the government is gone. A lot of the infrastructure that you would expect is either still blocked or in the process of being rebuilt. So there wasn't. It's not bustling yet. I imagine it will have to be at some point. But right now there are still people walking around, riding around. Just still in shock.
Still trying to figure out what to do with themselves.
Yeah.
And we say it's a small island nation. Geographically, it's not really that small. There's hundreds of miles between islands.
There are 700 islands, and yes, it's a huge place. The closest island is only 50 miles off the coast of Florida, though. But from north to south and east and west, it's a big place.
Yeah, I like that you included a map in there so we can get, like, here's what we're talking about. It really hit here, so a lot of these people are now going to Nassau, which was really not hit, and they're fine.
Nassau was fine, yeah. It's the capital, and that's where the government center stuff is.
I would say Nassau did have some flooding, and but it wasn't a massive damage or anything like that there, but there was some flooding in Nassau.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The places that were hit, though, tell me about those places. Are those places that would see tourists every once in a while?
Yes.
But they're obviously not now at this point. But.
We only went to one island. We went to Marsh Harbor, which is on Great Abaco. We did not go to Free – although Andrew, initially, like the day after?
2 days after, I flew over from east to west. So I started – we flew in from Florida. We moved from over Freeport and Grand Bahama and then over the Abacos. And you could see the damage as it went from west to east. Like the western part of the Bahamas, like Grand Bahama – didn't seem to be that damaged. You could see that there was probably like a lot of flooding damage. But as you moved east, it was just, you could see like the destruction as you moved over basically like the eastern part of Grand Bahama. And then as you moved over the Abacos, it was just, you could just see the destruction and just littered houses, roofs, tops off and that kind of stuff. Whereas other parts, it seemed to be a little bit more flooding. And then as you moved into Marsh Harbor, we flew over the general area, which is the mud and the pigeon pea and that area that just got hammered. And you could see that's where the storm surge really just pretty much annihilated the whole area there. And then we moved over to some of the outer islands as well, like Great Quanakee and Maniwaki. And you could see that some of those houses were just exceptionally damaged. But then as you moved back either a little bit south, the damage wasn't as bad. So it was like a large, like maybe like a 15-mile swath, but just in that swath, just utter mayhem. But what I thought going over the Grand Bahama, I thought the western part, which is where it actually like kind of did that turn thing mm-hmm. for a long time, where it rotated, wasn't that like structurally damaged. You could see the maybe it was flooding, but not structurally, which was made me thought it was. I think that the eye might have been just north of the island itself, and yeah. so it seemed like the southern part of the storm didn't do that much structural damage.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I found it interesting in some of the pictures you'd see complete devastation and then one house that looked like it was built yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
It was weird. Like newer construction seems like it did a little better sometimes.
It's hard to say because we're not on the ground. We're not seeing it. But I would say that like it seems like if the hurricane codes are up to date and the newer houses seem to do a little bit better. I saw some pretty modern houses that were just trashed. I mean, unfortunately, yeah. so it's like this.
Well, the one guy that you guys talked with, he went out through his rafters. He had to go through his ceiling and save people. And his
but
family.
He had a newer house.
He had hurricane-resistant
yes, and
the whole window came out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right out of the wall.
The structure was still standing, but the windows were gone. And
the doors and didn't make it.
Right.
Could you recount for me that guy's story with his zip line that he kind of invented?
Sure. His name is Anthony Morley and his wife is Anne. He is he's a lifelong artist. He taught. He's now retired. Anne was still a teacher at the Catholic school in Marsh Harbor, and she had never seen a hurricane.
Right.
And she said she wanted to experience a hurricane.
Well, she saw the biggest one on record, I think it is, right?
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. So they were home. They had prepared. They had gotten their water and their food and they did what we do when a hurricane is coming, and they were in a house that they thought was safe. And it was at night, right, Andrew, when the water started to rise. And she said, well, honey, it's coming up pretty fast. And then there was a pop and a crash, and the window was out, and the water was rising. And she's not a tall woman. They had a ladder in the back room. He said, well, stand on this ladder as it keeps rising.
Well, he was so cute. He goes, well, the water is getting up to about 4 or 5 feet, and she's only 2 feet. That was his joke. I loved him.
Yeah.
He's like, we can laugh now. I'm like, really? Because that's pretty quick.
Yeah. Yeah. They're leaning on each other, too.
They're great.
Yeah. It's nice to see them. So, but eventually the water kept rising, mm-hmm. and it really got so that it was scary. So they moved the ladder to a back room. And he somehow found the strength to put a hole in the ceiling. And it's not a crappy little particleboard ceiling.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
It was nice.
It was wood.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Tongue. And somehow he managed to punch through that, get her up to the rafters. And then he swam.
He had to swim out underneath a doorway. And then he made his way to a tackle shop, I believe.
They live a couple structures down is a tackle shop. It's mm-hmm. a bait and tackle shop like you would see in, Bonita Beach.
Mm-hmm.
And he made it to the tackle shop and
got a rope.
Yeah. Sort of a turquoise nylon woven rope
mm-hmm.
and strung it from the tackle shop. He had some posts and like a clothesline in his backyard and made a zip line to his house. And he was able to get Anne to safety with the zip line. And then also in a neighboring house, there were three generations of people. There was a grandma, a mom, and a three-month-old baby girl. And he was able to, using his hastily fashioned zip line, get them to the tackle shop. So they all spent the night. And the storm just went on and on and on. The storm was there for more than 48 hours, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Just waiting in the second story of this tackle shop, trying to hold the doors on and the windows on until the waters receded and they could finally come out.
It's just amazing that he even just thought to check on those people because he said he didn't hear anything and he didn't know for sure anybody was there. I just felt like somebody was probably there.
Yeah, he's a faithful guy. And a lot of people, religion is something that is very openly discussed now. A lot of people attribute their survival to higher powers, and the Morleys are firmly in that camp, and when they talk about rebuilding as well, it's because of their faith, and they feel like they were saved for a reason.
So okay, you had done a flyover before, like right after the storm.
Yes,
and then you guys were going over this time, like last week, right?
Yeah.
So what were you feeling like as you landed and put feet on the ground after having flown over it and walking? I mean, how do you walk into these communities, and what did it kind of feel like to you?
I mean, during the storm, basically that day we flew over, we did actually get on the ground for a few minutes, kind of like in Treasure Cay. So it was amazing because we talked to a few people there, and it was just, you could see the shock in their faces and their eyes. And they're just saying, one guy is just saying, we were just grabbing kids. And it's just, you know, talking about how bad, this is like about 20 miles west of Marsh Harbor. So they were just talking about how bad Marsh Harbor was. And they were just talking, like, we could overhear people, like somebody was saying something to the effect of, like, they're just stacking bodies there. So you're just getting this, how bad is it, you know? Mm-hmm. And then, but then a month later, it's like, for us, it's like a logistical issue, you know, mm-hmm. getting in, there's so much that goes into getting on the ground. And
the airport had only recently reopened, and the roads were, you know, parts of the roads were still blocked, there was no gas, and, you know, all of the logistical stuff with which we're familiar because of our hurricanes was just multiplied.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, on an island, it's not a whole lot easier, right?
Yeah.
So did you encounter people as soon as you started walking to Marsh Harbor? Or?
Yes, although not a lot. When we were in Marsh Harbor, we stayed in a tent on the tarmac that USAID, the Agency for International Development, had set up. They were there coordinating with the Bahamian government because they have experience and they go all over the world disaster people. So that's, we came into that camp, and of course it was very tidy and squared mm-hmm. away and clean and just sort of the ultra fantasy of mm-hmm. what a foreign government can swoop in and do. And so moving out from that to these areas that were just scattered and blown apart, and there's nowhere for anyone to live. Except a few places sort of out of the epicenter of damage. There was one person we met, a young woman with her mom and with a little nephew when we were in Nassau. They had gotten sort of a hotel voucher the way we do after when FEMA puts people mm-hmm. up in hotels. They sort of had the equivalent there. But they were trudging up the hill with a bag of Salvation Army donations because they were worried they were about to get kicked out of their hotel. They'd mm-hmm. been there for 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And their time was ending. We talked with her. Andrew got some video of her. And she said, well, my dad is still back in Marsh Harbor. The house got severely damaged, but he wanted to stay and guard it. Yeah.
There's going to be work there back in Marsh Harbor, obviously. So a lot of people are kind of sitting back and waiting for those jobs to come to, like, start actually rebuilding and that kind of thing.
But some of them are so torn up. And we were talking about the cleanup efforts before we sat down. It's kind of, you can't just go in with a front end loader and start pulling stuff up because you don't know what's in there, because they have a lot of people that are still unaccounted for.
Yes, there were, I think the last time I checked, there were still 608 people who were missing, but those are only the missing people who are known and registered. And one of the challenges with this, especially in the Marsh Harbor area, is that so many of the people were there. I mean, it's sort of like the equivalent of when people come over to work in Immokalee and they don't necessarily have their papers in order. They don't have papers, period. So these aren't people who were officially known to the government. And so finding them, counting them, knowing who's gone is a real
and identifying
challenge.
Yeah, everything. Well, it's part of the story was that some people didn't go to the shelters because they were afraid of the government coming down on them.
Exactly,
which I don't think we realize is happening right there. I mean, you know, because you don't really think outside your own bubble most of the time, but you just don't realize that that's something that's also happening. And one of the other things that came out of your story that I think was really interesting is that there were a lot of Haitian people. There's a Haitian community there that had kind of a little community and some structures and buildings and stuff that have been completely destroyed. And you reported that there have a do not rebuild order in that area.
Yeah, this had been sort of a thorn in the government side and the rest of the community at large, because it was a salt marsh, essentially. Mm-hmm. With nothing there, and some people had initially been brought over to work on a plantation, and I think that's who initially settled that region. But then, you know, as happens with chain migration, people come, they know somebody, they put up a house next to someone else's, mm-hmm. and then also people, when they raft over from Haiti, sometimes wind up in the Bahamas, and so they went there, and little by little, these settlements, and the two that we saw and talked to most people are called the Mud with two D's, mm-hmm. and the other one is Pigeon Pea or Pigeon Peas. But there are a couple of others too in the area.
But those are the two that had been
those
hit.
Those were the two that had been really hit, and the construction was casual, I guess. I mean, you know, they sort of built with what was available.
Well, if you don't have citizenship, you're probably not going down to get a building permit.
Exactly.
Right.
And so that's why these buildings got wiped out. But yeah, it was a substantial Haitian population. And even when kids were born in the Bahamas, unlike the United States, where if you're born here, you have birthright citizenship, the end, period. In the Bahamas, the deal is that you have to wait until you're 18. And then during the year between your 18th and 19th birthday, you can apply for Bahamian citizenship. You don't necessarily get it. You have to have, you know, you have to have your paperwork in order. You have to pay a fee. And then there have to be testimonies to your good character. I don't think you can have been arrested or so you're not guaranteed to get Bahamian citizenship. So there are a bunch of young people or were young people there who are essentially stateless. And mm-hmm. initially when they were trying to encourage people after the storm to go to shelters, and they told them, don't worry, immigration is not going to be an issue. That's begun to change. And that's something that the Bahamian media is paying attention to, because now there's talk of beginning to do sweeps in the shelters for
really?
People who, yeah. Then that's something we'll be following.
You went to Haiti after mm-hmm. The 2010 earthquake,
right,
which devastated that island and led to a lot of Haitians leaving.
Right.
How would you compare the experience of going to Haiti after 2010 and this experience of going to the Bahamas?
Well, after Haiti, it was like I was there almost like 2 days later. And so it was like it was a disaster zone then. I mean, this is a disaster zone, but the immediacy of being in a disaster zone right after something happens, there's like a lot more. We were seeing like a lot of medical aid being, you know, given to people. We were people being carried out. You could still we're going into hospitals, and I was, you know, photographing kids who lost their leg and they're still getting, like, you know, amputations and that kind of stuff. So the immediacy was much different than this. Like going into this, the disaster zone seems to be like the same or, you know, more here. But I think that everybody's already out. And so there's not that you're looking for more. Like in Haiti, it was like just it's everywhere. You're looking for moments and that kind of thing. And you're shooting all kinds of different situations. Like, and there's like a lot more people in after the Haitian earthquake, like in the general
still there,
area,
yeah.
still there. Whereas coming into Bahamas, it was like a sort of a ghost town. You'd see like there's still a lot of people there, but not as congregated. So
yeah. The
differences, I guess, are just right after the Bahamas, like if we would have gotten there, if I would have been on the ground like in Marsh Harbor right after at the airport, I think it would have been a
totally different thing. Yeah.
Totally different situation.
Could you imagine the mindset of a person who went from Haiti after the 2010?
Right.
Thing, and then ended up in the Bahamas, kind of set up a little life there, and then this. I just can't imagine. And what did you hear anybody talking at all about, and I know by then it had already been said it's not going to happen, the granting of temporary protected status to anybody from the Bahamas that had been impacted by this. Was anybody talking about that at all, or that was just a foregone conclusion?
Not that we heard. We did encounter people. One of the shelters that we got into in Nassau was in a neighborhood called the Fox Hill area, and we talked to several people who asked us how to get to the United States, and, you know, can we tell them where to go in Miami? And I mean, so the desire is still there. But I don't think that there was much hope of doing it through official channels.
Yeah, I found it interesting, too, that there didn't seem like there was a whole lot of hope that the government was going to come through with any assistance either in the Bahamas, not the U.S. government.
That's a tricky one. Yeah.
It was interesting. People were like, yeah, we're not waiting. We're just going to rebuild it ourselves with what we've got. Yeah. And I found that really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I guess in the Outer Islands, that's a resiliency there. I mean, they're already self-reliant. And so there seemed to be like, we're just going to get this done. We don't care. We don't need the government to come in and help us. And even like when we were in Marsh Harbor area, we didn't see much government helping there. There's a lot of aid coming into all the ports and stuff, but definitely not, I would say. Amy needs to probably say this better than I can, because I'm not coming up with words. But
no, and what Andrew said is true. There is aid. It's from nonprofits, or as they say, NGOs, It's other countries' governments. The United States has a robust presence there. Mm-hmm. And the Bahamian government is...
I think they're still reeling.
Yeah.
They're still trying to get it... They're trying to wrap their heads around what actually occurred there.
And I think that a lot of the bureaucrats who... would normally be in Marsh Harbor. Mm-hmm, there's mm-hmm. a government center there where, you know, you pay your taxes and...
Well, they're working on their own houses probably, right?
Yeah, or a lot of them have gone to NASA. They've sort of tried to consolidate government mm-hmm. functions in NASA. So the government center there is a ghost town. And in the government building, there are USAID tents. And so people mm-hmm. from the United States are doing the administrative things one would expect the Bahamian government. But this was something we asked the woman who's the spokesman for their equivalent of FEMA. It's NEMA. And she said, well, you know, when you see people in the shelters, that's the Bahamian government. And when you see people manning the hospitals, that's the Bahamian government. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't the most robust answer. And I think, again, it's a very small country. It's just had the most traumatic, catastrophic national disaster it's ever experienced, and it's still struggling to find its footing.
What I found interesting, too, is one person described the post-hurricane help honeymoon.
Yes.
Like that time when everybody's rushing in to help. Is that coming to an end?
There is the fear that it will. But some of the non-governmental organizations and nonprofits for whom this is not their first rodeo know that their help is going to be required for the long haul. Even we ran into a couple from Naples. They have a cafe. She's a disc jockey, but they have incredible warm feelings for the Bahamas and have vacationed there all of their lives. And she gathered up some aid and put it in suitcases. She hauled more than 100 pounds of stuff to give to people who have relatives in Marsh Harbor. And she said it was the first time I'd heard it. This is a marathon, not a sprint. Mm-hmm. And since then, that concept has been echoed. But I think as the world becomes more accustomed to disasters like this, and as things change and disasters like this are more severe, the knowledge base increases.
Yeah.
And I think people realize that this, yes, there's the initial phase where you look around and you say, God, you know, I'm still alive. That's great. We survived this, and all the help pours in, and Jose Andres shows up with his food, and then there's the ongoing slog, and I think people are bracing themselves for that.
Yeah, it does. And I got to say, my hurricane prep has changed since Irma, like how I get ready for – once you have the experience, like you say – everything, like how you deal with things in the future, kind of changes a lot. So, and I don't think I'm alone in that. I think it makes me a little nervous that the majority of the people that you're hearing about in the shelters are people that are from Haiti, and that they're now in fear of just having their lives already has been uprooted. Do you know what's next for that? Or are you just going to kind of watch it?
We are going to watch it. I don't know. They don't know. I'm not sure the government knows. It doesn't have – I mean, I think it has sort of theoretical structures in place and agencies. This created a crisis that brought something that's mm-hmm. sort of been able to be shelved mm-hmm. and backburnered. It brought it right up to the forefront.
Well, it had already been a tense, you know, push and pull there.
It had been tense, but at least people had a place to live. The kids went to school.
Yeah.
Because even though they're not necessarily entitled to citizenship, kids in the Bahamas are entitled to education. So all the Haitian kids were going to school. They were integrated in the culture and community. So now that's gone. They have no homes, period. And so the government is going to have to deal.
One of the things that I thought that you're really probably going to dig into, just because it's a point of interest in its history, is that old picture that you found. And I mean, you mentioned the woman from Naples, and I'm thinking about the connections between our area and the Bahamas and the people that I know who have places there or that go there a lot. Then I saw that old picture that you found. Tell me about that picture that you found.
It's from the late 1800s. It is in front of a place called the Peacock Inn in Coconut Grove. Coconut Grove was essentially founded by Bahamians. Mm-hmm. And a lot of other communities in the Southeast Coast have very strong ties to the Bahamas. And still people go back and forth. And those were all Bahamian workers who had come, and they were the pioneers of Coconut Grove. And the University of Florida has done a whole bunch of really interesting research that I just discovered and I'm just digging into now. People have written scholarly papers about this and about the cultural connections. So it's not just the people who have the yachts and the second homes. There are very warm community ties and churches. And the same thing is true in the Keys. Key West's sister city is Green Turtle Cay. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of families. You know, my family was here and then they went to the Bahamas and then they came back to the Keys. And these are people who make their living with marine salvage or fishing. And so there's a very similar feel. The conchs in the Keys are a lot like the Bahamian people too.
Yeah, so. Living on an island, it's kind of got a similar thing. I was just imagining that when I saw the picture. I'm like, oh, I just can imagine the rabbit holes I go into on the internet sometimes.
Oh, me too.
I'm imagining that with you. You're just like, what time do you go to bed at night? Like at 2 a.m. I can't stop looking for stuff.
Yeah.
It's got to be fun. So, Andrew, I wanted to ask you, did you have were there any photos that you decided not to take while you were there because it was too much?
Not in the Bahamas, no.
No?
Yeah, pretty much in every situation, I analyze everything and I look at sensitivities and all those kinds of things. So like in Haiti, there were times when I wouldn't shoot just because of the sensitivity or of like seeing something that was just the public doesn't need to see.
Yeah.
And it's just – but in the Bahamas, I felt like we were past that point. So, I mean, you're still talking to people and asking, hey, can we photograph you and those kinds of things. It's kind of like this give and take between, you know, permissions and not permissions of what people are, you know, dealing with. But – not in the Bahamas. I felt like pretty much everything was free game. We didn't see anything that was totally out of the ordinary. Like, actually, we were only in Marsh Harbor and those areas for about a day and a half. Most of our work was done in Nassau because when we were sent, we were trying to figure out, it was like what was happening in Nassau because that's where all the evacuees went, all the students went there. So, you know, so we were trying to do a lot of work out of the shelters. And then you needed to get to the Marsh Harbor just because of that's where all the major damage was. And photographically, I was having enough of Nassau because I was going, okay, there's not much going on here, you know. But I needed to see what it was actually like in Marsh Harbor and in the areas that were hardest hit. And it was pretty much free game.
There's been discussion about the smell also, that because there's so many people that haven't been found. And we talked
about.
You guys said you didn't really sense that a whole lot, but just little pockets here and there.
I think right after the storm and like a week after, there's probably like a lot
more,
a lot going on there. Kind of like within Haiti, like within that week after, there's you're smelling stuff that probably is what you think it is.
Yeah.
However, when we were there, a lot of it, I smelled like we would go through different neighborhoods and pockets and you could smell it. But and you would think that's the smell of death. But then for the most part, it was... I would say the smell of death wasn't that
prevalent
where we were.
Another smell too that it's not a death smell and it's actually not even an unpleasant smell, but is all the vegetation that was stripped from the trees. The trees were debarked and defoliated. And so there was sort of a rotting vegetation smell too. I mean, it smelled like a mulch pile in places just because there was so much horticultural damage.
I think too that we were trying to kind of quell some rumors as well, because like as in Nassau, you would hear, like, we would talk to these students and they're like, we hear they're burning bodies in the streets, we hear there's a cholera outbreak, we would hear, you know, we're hearing all this, and Amy and I were looking at each other going, we didn't see any of that, you know. So it's like we were actually the fact finders, you know, for a lot of this stuff, and we're telling people back in Nassau saying it's horrific there, but they're not burning bodies in the streets, and
we're not seeing
a cholera outbreak. At least what we didn't see might be, but and like in a lot of there was like a lot of talk of like refugee camps or not
tent cities,
and we didn't see any of that either.
Yeah,
and so that was the expectation maybe as we were flying in. We're going to fly over, like, you know, there's going to be like this massive amounts of tent cities.
Like Mad Max beyond Thunderdome.
It's just going to be like this, this, you know, apocalyptic thing. Whereas Marsh Harbor does look like that, but you're not seeing that mass humanity there.
And the people are they're storing things in refrigerated trucks, as you said. So they're storing people.
Freezer trucks.
They found, you know.
Bodies. Yeah.
So, and then.
We were able to talk to the coroner there, and I think Amy can probably.
Yeah. In Marsh Harbor, the medical center / hospital is where bodies, when they are found, are brought there to be. It's a really complicated, time-consuming process. So if they can be recognized facially and if there's a relative who can, they'll do that. But even when that can happen, they still have to send tissue back to NASA to be run through a database. And so in the meantime, people's bodies are stored in, it looks like a tractor trailer that you'd see carrying stuff to Publix. It says tropical. On the side of it. And it's just parked out back behind the hospital running day and night.
It's going to be hard, too, because there's going to be a lot of people that are not going to have any closure.
Mm-mm. You're right about that.
Because there's going to be a lot of people that were just swept away into the water.
Yeah.
And that one poor kid that you talked to, student.
Still having nightmares. And
he's got friends that he thinks were swept away and that he thinks were eaten by sharks, he thinks.
Yeah. I mean, he's a really tough little kid, too.
He seemed like
he was very proud. Both of his parents are in the police force, and he is sort of the equivalent of a ROTC kid. He's the junior defense force ranger.
Oh.
So he said, I'm tough. I know how to handle this. You just keep going forward. And then he said, but at night, especially when it's raining and you see on the news that these hurricanes are forming out. That's when I get scared and I have trouble sleeping.
Oh, poor kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one common theme I think I heard, too, is that even raindrops on the roof is terrifying to some of these people. I mean, it's like they just don't – this whole situation has just totally shocked them into like this where they're – they just don't – like we have Carrie, the lady we talked to in Nassau with her
whose
family.
Whose dad was back in Marsh Harbor.
She's – I mean you just see the like the eyes, and it's just evident that they've been through so much trauma, and it's like it's really sad to see,
And trauma's a funny thing. Yeah. It's not like, through 3 weeks has passed, you're fine. I mean trauma haunts you for years.
Yeah,
there's going to have to be – some ongoing work done.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was another common theme, too, talking about the mental health aspect of what these people are going to go through. Yeah, we talked to several people who just – some of the stories are just insane. I mean, just on the roofs, one guy was telling us about, how he was on the second story of his house, but he could look over and see people on their roof, and it's – the water is literally almost over the roof. And you're just hearing – just common themes of that. So it's like, that these people were dealing with this incredible amounts of surge,
And it wasn't just for 10 minutes.
No, I think it was going on for hours.
Days. Yeah. I mean, everyone keeps remarking how weird it was that this thing just stalled and slowed down to 1 mile an hour progress.
So do you think you're going to be going back for another round of reporting on this or –
we'll have to ask our overlords. I would love to.
Well, once you make those connections with these people, it's kind of hard not to go back.
Amy's great because she's talking about she'll get a text or she'll get some kind of message on WhatsApp about, hey, this is where we are now. She's keeping a contact.
Yeah, I'm absolutely keeping in touch with the people we spoke to.
It's great reporting with her because she's so involved, it's awesome.
It's probably great for her reporting for you because you get the best visuals.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes.
It's like a dream team
and
over
this
here.
Guy never stops. Andrew has the most incredible, I don't think he sleeps.
Because you're in the rabbit hole on the internet finding stuff, and he's you're at the right thing. You guys are just really great. I really appreciate you coming in and talking with me about your experiences there in the Bahamas and telling us, firsthand what it's like. And I look forward to additional reporting on it, too.
Thank you.
Do you have more stories coming out about from this trip?
I think there's another one coming out Sunday. Yeah.
All right.
And it's about Florida and especially Southwest Florida's warm ties to the Bahamas.
And that
picture figures into that.
And also to end it on a high note, there were people that you talked with in your reporting too that were really enthusiastic about a new beginning and rebuilding Abaco Island
yes.
into a unified place where everybody has their place.
Yes.
And while there are the, we don't really want this little lean-to town or this little thing, there are other people that are like, we all need to have a place, we all need to have schools, and we all need it. So that was at least a little uplifting.
Very heartening.
That's all the time we have for today's show. I want to thank my guest, Amy Bennett-Williams, senior writer and storyteller for the News Press. Amy, thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
And also Andrew West. He's a photographer and visual storyteller for the News Press. Andrew, thanks for coming in and for all your hard work.
Thanks.
That's all the time we've got for today's show. You can hear our full unedited conversation on our website, gulfcoastlive.org. If you missed any of our conversation, you can hear all of our episodes in their entirety on our website, or you can subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary and myself. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.